thanks for joining me for another Blunt Business on CannabisRadio.com. Really appreciate all of you joining us. If you haven't done so, if you haven't subscribed to the show yet, please do so, Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and please rate and review the show. And of course, you can find all of our programming, CannabisRadio.com. Let's get right to our guest. You may remember on our Blunt Business program earlier this year, back in February, I spoke with Robert Hoban, chair of the cannabis practice at Clark Hill, and we went through a various number of issues, and it was also prior to the DEA's reclassification or rescheduling. Again, not descheduling, rescheduling of cannabis from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. Now, of course, this has been the discussion ad nauseum across all the media for cannabis here and also cannabis radio. We're not any exception to that. But now that this change has already been made and we're going to get the final process to be laid out, the final framework to be laid out, the folks at Clark Hill granted us a couple of other distinguished attorneys for themselves to come on and join us once again so we can talk more about the areas of reclassification that are not being talked about here on the program. And here, joined by attorneys at Clark Hill, Kevin Williams and Craig Small. Kevin and Craig, thanks for being on with us.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Appreciate you making time to go and join us here. And so just to be make get some point, Craig, you are based in Denver, you're a corporate attorney, and then Kevin, you are more in the focus of international trade. But there's some areas that are very interesting in terms of what reclassification means, and that was put on your website. And first of all, let's go into what was a story that, Craig, you wrote earlier in this month of May about what's titled The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, DEA Rescheduling Marijuana to Schedule 3. So
right.
Going into this, you mentioned that, you know, one of the primary barriers that we've had an issue for cannabis when it comes to research because of the issues that we want to go ahead and be able to further disprove any myths or any, you know, misinformation about cannabis and the actual benefits that it has into various different normalities, whether it's PTSD, whether it's, you know, epilepsy, whether it's cancer, whether it's weight loss, if it might be. But the thing is, we want to be able to have the research out there available, and it's always been so much a struggle. So you make a point, Craig, in the article that Schedule 3 would streamline the research process by allowing scientists greater access to cannabis for clinical studies, including health benefits and risks associated with more than 100 cannabinoids produced or derived from the cannabis plant. So we know about that. We know also about the 280E distinction now being removed so that companies can now basically write off, you know, expenses as any other conventional business can. But there are some other areas that are pointed out here, and I want to go and point those out real quickly. First of all, we know that the change will make it where it's now being scheduled in the same way as prescription drugs like ketamine or Tylenol with codeine. But one area that is interesting to me, well, if you had to say there were three different areas that are not being talked about in terms of what reclassification is not being discussed, what are like the other underlying factors that are not getting the headlines? If you had to pick a couple of those out, what would those be, Craig, first to you?
Certainly one of the most important aspects of this, I think, is immigration law. And it's very, very strict standard when it comes to the green card holders or unlawful citizens, people who are in the United States who don't quite have all their documentation lined up, or even if they do have a documentation lined up, that they can't participate in the cannabis industry because any infraction would have been an infraction of the Controlled Substance Act for a Schedule 1 drug. It doesn't go away when it goes down to Schedule 3, but the hope is that that'll be considered a lesser infraction and allow more people to participate in the cannabis industry, whether it's as a frontline employee or to be able to benefit from the use of cannabis.
Now, one of the things I talked about recently when I was talking to Anthony Caniglia, a new Lake Capital Partners, on a Blunt Business episode, we were talking about the fact that now with the DEA, you know, it's now they're going to be more involved in oversight. And one of the areas that's being brought up in the article is that they would have, or the FDA itself would actually be able to now regulate standardization. So I don't know if there's going to be any compliance issues, but again, they're just going for public comment. They're not really giving us any kind of, we're not expecting any kind of framework, much like the FDA wasn't able to do anything much when it comes to the hemp bill. It's very vague and cloudy and not much information. But the FDA now will now be involved more into cannabis, not just hemp. That tells us it's just the same route we've been at, a lot of vagueness and, you know, what's going to be allowed underneath the radar, that it's not going to be controlled or what's not going to be put under compliance. Is that an issue you also concern yourself with the fact that FDA now gets involved in this when they did such a bang-up job with the hemp bill?
Well, I think the FDA certainly tried to pass the ball back to Congress, and Congress is semi-dysfunctional, if not fully dysfunctional right now. Certainly no hopes in the next 9 to 12 months that we see some fix there. But certainly if there's some impetus for the FDA to want to change the law, every change in the milestones of towards cannabis legalization does change the framework of the conversation. And it does allow all these issues to be revisited. And whenever we can revisit an issue, then those voices can be heard again, that arguments can be made again, and hopefully this time we'll see some more progress. Rescheduling from 1 to 3 is a huge deal. It is the biggest change in marijuana law in 50 years. It may not be the biggest change that we want to see. It may not be the legalization that everyone's looking for, but it is a gigantic domino that fell, and hopefully it'll knock down more dominoes.
So you mentioned the immigration issue. The other part I would think that's also been underlying that I think it talked too much about is the access to research, and really for scientists to be able to have more access. So what I want to figure out is, are they going to be able to get more access now to more product? Can a researcher now be able to go and grab from a cultivator or cultivate their own for the sake of research now? It doesn't no longer have to be where, you know, it was always an issue about getting, you know, product for research, but it was always something where it was either dry and it wasn't really the best quality because of restrictions they had on it. Is this something where you feel like we don't know what they're going to be making those ramifications for that, but the access to actual product for more research that can be used, how much more do you think there will be now because of this rescheduling?
Well, I don't know the exact process as it goes to Schedule 3, but I do know with Schedule 1, in order to cultivate marijuana, you had to have a federally approved cultivation license. And I just can't imagine that the federal government is proficient at cultivating marijuana any better than the entire marijuana industry that's doing it for business purposes or even personal purposes. But certainly rescheduling down to Schedule 3, I would hope would open up the ability for more federal permits to maybe be placed in the private sector. Take these people who are already cultivating marijuana using very, very strict climate control methods, the highest technology, the best processes. Everything, if you ever go into these cultivation facilities, they look like data server because everyone takes this industry very seriously. And the product is a result of high-quality product that can be produced at a lower cost. So hopefully the federal government can start issuing some of these cultivation permits to already existing operators to take a dollar for dollar, apple for apple, marijuana bud for marijuana bud of what the consumer is consuming and actually testing that for its amount.
Now, I want to ask you, either one of you, one of the things I always wonder myself, I mean, for them to keep asking for public comment, for them to keep kicking the ball down the road, you know, they have existing laws that are in place in terms of compliance for hemp. They could go and apply the Cosmetics Act if they wanted to do that. For cannabis, they could be using good manufacturing practices. Pretty well a standard for other institutions, for other sectors. Why can't they just put those in? Why do you think it's such a difficult thing for them just to take an existing law that would work well for cannabis just like it does everywhere else? And, you know, there's no real changes to be made to it.
I think the issue is really more political will. And government doesn't move quickly in any direction. And it certainly moves even slower when it's changing. So for any particular government agency to want to make a major political shift in policy, it's going to have to come from someone higher up. And as we go higher up, the highest level we can go is President Biden, who's made a lot of promises and made a lot of a rhetoric on what he wants to see as far as the future of marijuana. He hasn't quite delivered on everything. To his credit, he's delivered more than prior presidents, which is fantastic. But certainly, it really is going to be top-down leadership that's going to be the major change.
Well, the rescheduling was the one thing I said, you know, all along. If you're going to get anything out of the Biden administration at all before election time, was going to be this. And at least take this carrot while you can, because this is is pretty good. There are some good things obviously they're going to take from this. That's why there's been so much good press about it. Yeah, but it's just people need to really just dig deep into what there is that will benefit. Now, one of the other areas I want to bring up that, Kevin, I want to make sure to bring you to the conversation here. It was one of those areas that they really hear much about when it comes to this. But here's this one thing that was brought up when we were bringing the interview together. And the question was posed to me was, when reclassification occurs, what will happen to the once illegal paraphernalia and all the support products for cannabis? And will the states decide on this as well? And how will U.S. Customs and Border Patrol handle import and export cases? Because there's a lot of money at stake. So, Kevin, I want to go ahead and pose that to you. Where do you see this?
Well, what I see here is, you know, the states have already taken action on this. Many states in their legalization of marijuana have included provisions in the statute for what most of them call legalization of marijuana accessories for, you know, devices that are used to consume marijuana, and they've legalized the possession of those. The issue is that that hasn't been done at the federal level, and so the drug control acts that are in place still make it illegal to import paraphernalia. And so what we've seen is that over the years, I've done issues on this my whole career, where customs have seized paraphernalia products as they come across the border if they happen to inspect that shipment. And we, with the legalization of marijuana in many states, we have, when products have been seized at a port in one of those states, we have challenged customs decision to seize the merchandise utilizing an exception in the law that makes it illegal to import them, that allows that overrides that that statute for in locations where it is legal under state, municipal, or local law. And customs has generally refused to acknowledge the existence of that exception. They've used where they have issued decisions, they have used convoluted language to try to claim that the federal law still takes precedence over the state laws. And they've just sat on the decisions. But so what, you know, they've refused to just make a decision. They just sit on the arguments and don't make a ruling on whether the seizure was legal. What we have done, and where we've seen some movement on this, is that if we take it out of customs hands and ask the Department of Justice to proceed with forfeiting the merchandise. That's a legal term, but we don't need to get into that right now. But it means that the government would take ownership of it. And in several cases, the Department of Justice has declined to proceed to forfeiture. And what that means is they said, we don't want to deal with this. Customs, give the goods back. And so Department of Justice decision not to proceed to forfeiture in these cases is a sign of the government relaxing its efforts to control the importation of drug paraphernalia. The other thing we have seen is there were two court cases that came out of state of Washington, mm-hmm. where the customs seized some products that were used to process marijuana, the marijuana plants, to process them into consumable products, and customs seized them. Their counsel, actually, customs didn't seize them. They refused to allow them importation, which is a little bit different procedurally than seizure. That allowed the importer to challenge the refusal to admit the products in the U.S. Court of International Trade, which is a special court that hears all cases related to importation. And the arguments that were made there were the same as the ones I had just laid out, that it wasn't illegal to have to possess or import this merchandise in the state of Washington due to their state statutes approving the legalization of marijuana and marijuana accessories. The Court of International Trade in both of these cases agreed with the importer and right. told Customs to admit the merchandise. So that's another sign that we've seen where the government is relaxing its stance on the prohibition of these imports.
Stay tuned. We have more Blunt Business coming up after a short break.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
Welcome back to Blunt Business. If you want to go and follow on the story that Kevin also wrote, a story specifically to this, marijuana rescheduling's impact on U.S. Customs and Border Patrol interdiction of drug paraphernalia. You can also find it, this and the story that Craig wrote on ClarkHill.com, just look under news and events. You'll find both articles there. Now, back to the story here with paraphernalia. The fact that the government is intervening on this, on being able to go ahead and seize what's called illegal paraphernalia, there's a couple of things I'm trying to figure out here to put my head around. Is what is constituting, what is it that constitutes illegal paraphernalia? You said it's obviously, it's devices that can be used either to process or to, help, consume, whatever can be used to consume cannabis is basically that area. But then there's also a part where, they're really distinguishing that and what's being made available on store shelves, because obviously we see paraphernalia all the time in various gas stations or vape shops or head shops or whatever there is that are out there for people to go and buy. And then, the fact that, if a police officer wants to go and pull somebody over and in a voluntary search, they're able to go ahead and find paraphernalia, but they might, obviously it gives them the suspicion to go and find product. That part really, it's kind of the gateway to go and, continue to have the issues of criminalization in areas where states are already, fully legalized for adult use or medical in some way, shape, or form, but yet people are still getting, charged with a misdemeanor or felelony because suspicion of possession or distribution, all that going into play. So what can you do to help me distinguish for our listeners? What is it they're trying to worry about that they're trying to seize and what people could be charged with? What kind of paraphernalia are they worried about?
Well, as far as the what Customs and Border Protection is trying to seize, there's a list of items in the statute that are defined as paraphernalia. So it would be bongs, pipes, grinders. I don't consume marijuana, so I don't know the full list. But anything that you would use to to smoke marijuana, essentially.
But that's the part I'm trying to figure out. I mean, why are they going after the paraphernalia and they're saying it's illegal? Because, for some people, who knows, it might be decorative. Of course, you can go out and make the assumption that it's going to reach forward and say, well, somebody's going to use cannabis in it illegally, either purchased or, illegal to own or possess or distribute cannabis they might be putting into that. But that's a suspicion. That's not fact. And so I don't understand the part where, again, Customs and Border Protection and then the Court on International Trade have to be involved in this. Doesn't make sense to me. Go after the product. If you have to do it where there's, distinct rules within, federal oversight that there's still illegalities, go after those, not the paraphernalia.
No, I understood. And that, but you have to remember that these statutes were written back in the 70s and 80s when the war on drugs was at its at its height. And so they were trying to, not only go after the products themselves, but also the mechanisms that people were using to consume them. And so, that's how we got here. And, in customs, you find this stuff all over the place. The fact is that, customs just doesn't have the personnel and the wherewithal to inspect every shipment that comes in, so a lot of it gets through, and so it's just random that a shipment would get spotted and get seized by them. Now, as far as what goes on in when the local policeman pulls you over, that's outside my area of expertise. I'd let Craig address that if he can.
I can. And that's where marijuana law gets really interesting, because as soon as you have a path to lawful use, all those paraphernalia arguments go away. Because if you're even smoking hemp flower out of a glass bong, then there's no more probable cause. If you smell something from that bong, if law enforcement smells something on that bong, it's no longer probable cause that a crime was committed, because there is a lawful use for that bong, even if it's for a lower Delta-9 THC product. So we just don't have that on a federal level, which I'm hoping that this rescheduling down to 3 might create some path towards federal lawful use of marijuana, because as soon as we can create that path and argue in court and win it in court, that all the paraphernalia arguments go away, because all of that paraphernalia can be used for a federally lawful purpose.
And we don't know, and the police officers are going to know if it's Delta agent tonight or Kratom or some other sort of synthetic cannabinoid. Again, other, it's like, this is so vague. But again, this I put on the federal government. You have laws that are existing that can be applied, which I mentioned, the Cosmetics Act, good manufacturing practices. They're already regulated for other business industries. You can put those and apply those today and take that extra work off your plate. No new bills being added, no new conjecture. Just apply the same standards that were put in for years. And then you have laws like this that are antiquated that need to be updated when it comes to paraphernalia, because, you know, it's still, they come back from the war on drugs. And I make the same joke that President Biden is probably still a Senate judiciary talking to Max Mermelstein and Barry Steele during the Cocaine Cowboys days, because they still think it's the 80s like that again. They just don't get it. But again, out of touch federal government that, you know, they're just not. You know, there's no proactivity. I'm asking for the world if that can actually happen, but it's not going to. But well, it's these kind of things. Yeah, go ahead.
I think what we're seeing is, you know, the administration, the executive branch, is limited in what it can do based upon existing law. And they're pushing the envelope as far as they can. With what they can do, they can essentially tell customs, don't stop looking for this, just behind the scenes, they can do that sort of thing. But until Congress becomes functional again, hopefully, and takes action on some of this to change the laws, the executive branch is limited in what it can do. But then the states are pushing forward on their side.
But now, the other thing too, I also think about was, and I haven't brought this up on any other program, but reclassification now is in place. This doesn't prompt policymakers to start furthering the state. Let's go ahead and get the bill passed. Let's get a states act or some kind of federal oversight act that we've already written in several bills. We can just put one up for vote. They haven't gone that far yet. It's a matter of, what is it? They just like the cannabis money that's coming in from lobbying, the $40 million or whatever it is they're making right now, and they'll just keep taking it without having to do much else? Because I don't see them, prompted to do anything more because of this. It's not like this, now this just changes. It's going to open up a few more, issues that are going to come into play. They're not going to respond to it. Congress is not ready to respond to it. So things will just continue to kind of go ahead and unravel because these new levers of power have been switched and pulled because the executive branch decided to do so. So it could create more of a quagmire than anything else. But we just need to focus on the fact that there's a few things that are beneficial to the industry itself that they need to kind of take advantage of when it comes to research, when it comes to the tax write-offs, and, all that. But still, there's so much more to be said, but that was never going to be an answer from this. But this is also not going to prompt Congress to do anything more aside from just like, oh, they did this, but they're not going to move forward. Do you think so, or does this make a change?
Not yet, Brasto, not yet. But it takes every election shift. Every election cycle, when you're getting new politicians in or old politicians out or incumbents have to fight for their seats, that's where I think you're going to see changes. I think it's too much to ask an administration that spent its entire career advocating for a war on drugs to all of a sudden advocate for the solution against the war on drugs. It's just the mindset just can't wrap themselves around it. And what little bit that they can, I don't think that they have really the energy or the impetus to want to push it forward. So while I appreciate what President Biden is doing, I it takes a presidential cycle in order for that shift to occur. And we're going to see it in pieces here and there. I don't know that we're going to see major legalization in the near future being, you know, the next presidential cycle. But certainly each time that we have one of these elections and a younger generation can get themselves into political office, then we're going to start seeing more political will to change. I would have thought that we would have had marijuana legalization as soon as we had more than 25 states that legalized it on the books. So I would have thought, well, now we have it in the Senate. The Senate can get the House to push it forward, and our presidential administration will have to do that. And I think that was naive on my part because I didn't put enough weight on the politics and what goes on behind the scenes, the lobby that goes on, and the generational shifts that need to happen.
Stay tuned. We have more Blunt Business coming up after a short break.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
Welcome back to Blunt Business. I appreciate the thought that you would think that if it was more a majority of states that you could probably get there. I mean, well, that honestly, it warrants the reason why a bill could be put up for a vote now, because you have more than half the states that are already, you know, allowing a medical use, and then adult use is getting to the point where, yeah, it's going to be overwhelmingly in favor. I mean, you're going to see maybe not all states, but at the end of it, maybe a couple of states will be holdouts. After all, I think Texas might be one of those. Who knows? But one of the things is that as long as Big Pharma's around, you know, Craig, I think we're just not going to, you know, when they're spending four times as much than cannabis is right now, they're the ones who want to really hold back on cannabis getting moved forward. And then on top of that, you know, as long as we have this super division right now in Congress, I think everybody can agree. Everyone in a political sense could agree. If we had one super majority in the House and Senate, and I don't even matter who's the president on which side it is. I think if both houses of Congress, they were both super majorities from one party to the other, then I think we could finally get to the point where a bill could be passed. And I think that's the only way it happens now, is that where there's enough where, and I think both sides would look at cannabis, because at least as a super majority, you'd actually have bills that could be put up and actually be signed. Because right now, what bills are getting signed and what's being done now? Nothing. Again, and right. Congress. I think if we had something where Congress was able to go ahead and be all in lockstep of each other, and they could easily pass resolutions or motions to get the bills, the votes, then would be a different story. Would it be better for one or the other? I'm not going to talk about that, because of course, obviously, if it's one side or one or the other, there's going to be a minority or majority of people that are not going to be happy about it, but Congress will be moving like it's supposed to.
I think America
cannabis would be allowed to be able to move as well.
Yeah. I think Americans are pretty fed up with U.S. politics, and while it certainly is a sad situation we have today, it will not last forever. Like I said, election cycles change everything. I remember when the Tea Party was the big news, and everyone was saying, "How big the Tea Party?" Now they're gone. So, whether you're a Democrat or whether you're a Republican, no matter what you think on this, when we see the extremists on both sides, all of that will go away someday. I just don't know when. But to get to your point about Big Pharma, yes, they have control conversation, and the fact everyone knows money speaks in D.C. So the lobbying power is strong. But again, the optimist in me says that they've had a vice grip on the conversation for the past 40 years, and they no longer have that vice grip. The society is pushing past their ability to limit our voices. Now, so we see significant change on the state level because the national level wasn't going to do it. And now we're seeing change on the national level and Big Pharma. I kind of see them as some evil out there. It may not be just them. It may not be only them. And certainly they have business interests that they're trying to protect. But the fact is they no longer control the discourse. And over time, we are chipping away at this. And we will get legalization. I have no doubt about it. It's just a matter of making sure that our voices are heard, even with this rulemaking process. You know, I know there's going to be the feeling that if I make a comment, it's just going to go into some database somewhere and no one's going to listen to me. That may be true, but if we can get 50 million comments out there, that cannot be more. So I certainly encourage everyone to get involved in this rulemaking process with the DEA. I would ask that you focus your comments on productiveness and And if you're going to present the problem, also present the solution that's within the framework of this rulemaking. If everyone just issues 50 million comments of legalized marijuana, I don't know that it's going to get the result.
We're leave it there.
Let me make one more comment, and Craig can rebut this if he chooses to. An easier path forward for the federal government may just be to say, we're going to leave it up to the states. We're not going to legalize it. We're just going to do away with all of this the drug control wars legislation. We're going to repeal all of that and then leave it up to the states to decide whether they want to legalize it or not.
Yeah, the issue there is the U.S. is part of international treaties that require marijuana to be a scheduled drug. And so to take it off the schedule altogether would violate international treaties. I'm not an expert on the national treaty. I know there are creative ways that diplomats can skirt the issue, and I just don't know the solution.
Okay, that makes sense.
General, we're going to leave it there.
We haven't treaties in the past, but...
yeah. All right, let's go and leave it there. Gentlemen, again, website for both of you, for the law firm is clarkhill.com. And again, I would implore you, go to the news and events section to go and look for both of their articles that are featured there on the website. And for those, you know, for either one of you that, you know, why they should go ahead and be able to reach out to one of you specifically, the areas that you cover. I know that, Craig, you specifically work in the state of Colorado, obviously a well-defined state that's gone for more than a decade of, you know, success and have had a really as the framework of the role model that many other states have gone on and gone online with their medical or adult use programs going forward. And I know, Kevin, you work in the international trade side, so obviously the area with paraphernalia and the issues that might come up with, again, the Customs Border Protection, a quarter of international trade, and those areas, very important. But how they should go and connect with you individually, let us know what they should do best in terms of working with your firm and working with yourselves.
Certainly. Well, and yes, I am based in Colorado, but I represent clients in almost every marijuana state at some point or another, and even international. So certainly my practice to is broader than just Colorado. The beauty of Clark Hill is we have 700 plus attorneys that handle almost any area of the law that you're looking for. So we are kind of a one-stop shop for all legal needs. I'll let Kevin speak more to his practice. I do want to give you a plug, Brosco, because I'm a longtime listener of your show. And
thank
I
you.
Highly encourage if there's any listeners, this is their first time listening to the show, go back and listen to some of the older episodes, because the issues you raise and the issues you discuss, even going back to maybe 2019, 2020, are the same issues that we're dealing with in the industry today. And so your discussions are spot on.
Thank you very much. And it's just for... I'm just a spectator. I'm the person that's like kind of the backbencher, just watching from the crowd, enjoying with my popcorn, and I'm seeing all this, and I'm like, you know, and for me, I mean, to be honest, I'm not necessarily, I don't have any business invested interest in it. I don't have a financial stake at all. Just a commentator here. But it's one of those things where I'm amazed the audience that we have that listens to this program, and, you know, and I appreciate having the opportunity to have folks like you on to talk about this, because I look at it and I, you know, I'm not here to go and play wishful thinking or, you know, be, what's the word I'm always looking for? Oh, you know, positively, what was the word you always said? It was always, cautiously optimistic. That's the word we always hear. And I'm not doing that. I'm not playing happy talk. We're not doing any of that here. I want to just make the point and just, you know, just do the direction of these companies. And just, I look at it and this is the way I call it, the way I see it. And, you know, I appreciate the comments. Thank you so much, Craig, for saying it. And gentlemen, thank you both for being on. Again, the website, clarkhill.com. And we'll continue this conversation. Thank you both. Again,
thank you, Brosco.
Craig Spano, Kevin Williams with Clark Hill. Thank you all for being on the program. Really
thank
appreciate
you. It. Bye-bye.
And thank you, listeners. We'll talk to you next time.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.